This is Public. This is a podcast about cities, people and place.
This is Emma Telfer.
And this is Sally McPhee.
I'm the Executive Director of Open House Melbourne.
And I collaborate on projects that engage people in culture, nature, art and place. We live in Melbourne, Australia, and we love our city.
We've been friends for years, but come from kind of different careers.
But recently we've started working together on public programs about the city.
We saw the opportunity for documenting, sharing and making more public the content and ideas of our work.
And these same projects also bring together thinkers, doers and advocates
who are shaping our city.
To be public is to be shared. So this is us, sharing some of the stories, ideas and issues consuming our thoughts via a podcast. All made possible by the Metro Tunnel Creative Program. A program dedicated to enhancing city life alongside the construction of the Metro Tunnel.
Welcome to This is Public. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Sally.
And hello, everybody out there, and thank you for listening to episode 2 of This is Public, titled Future Needs.
And a very big thank you to everyone who listened to our last episode and our first episode, Waterfront. We hope you've taken some time since to get down to the river, maybe put your feet in, or even better, get involved in its future.
And speaking about the future, in this episode, we're chatting to two people who think about the future every day as leaders of city design. Christopher Hawthorne, the Chief Design Officer for the City of Los Angeles, and Rob Adams, Director of City Design for the City of Melbourne. Christopher and Rob joined us in the ESPY podcast studio thanks to the Living Cities Forum, a forum held in May, presented by the Naomi Milgram Foundation and supported by Open House. And a shout out to the Saturday morning audience who joined us for the live recording. Actually, Emma, do you want to tell us a bit about Living Cities?
Sure. So Living Cities is really built around the international thinkers who've been connected to the M Pavilion Summer Program. We invite them as part of the forum to speak about the role of design in addressing some of our most pressing challenges in cities. And they really bring this great kind of global perspective. So as part of the organising committee, I've been really happy to contribute Christopher to this year's program. He is the Chief Design Officer for Los Angeles, and I saw him at the AAO conference, or the Association of Architecture Organisations, that's a mouthful, in Seattle in 2018. And he was just 3 months into his newly created role. He's been the architecture critic for the Los Angeles Times for the last 15 years or so. And so really, he's a translator and a communicator first, even though he has an architecture background. And I think that's a really fascinating appointment for the City of Los Angeles.
Yeah, and it makes complete sense to appoint someone to this role who's engaged with architecture and considers what you might call the public good or the contribution of architecture to civic life. It's a holistic view, and as we'll hear today, it joins the dots between design and issues of equity, environment and social issues. And then we have Rob Adams at the opposite end of the spectrum. He's a practicing architect and urban planner who has been at the City of Melbourne for 35 years and has been quietly chipping away at improving major elements of the city, including the public realm. And he speaks a lot about the power of incremental change and the importance of playing the long game in city making.
We're sharing much of the in-depth conversation we have with Christopher and Rob at the ESPY podcast bar. So we suggest you strap yourselves in for this fascinating long-form conversation.
I'm Christopher Hawthorne. I'm the Chief Design Officer for the City of Los Angeles. That's a position based in the Mayor's Office in LA. A new position, newly created. I've been in it just more than a year. So really, I'm advising our mayor on issues related to urban design, architecture, and planning.
And I'm Rob Adams. I'm the Director of City Design at the City of Melbourne. Over actually 35 years now, I've worked with the city, having put in place a strategy back in 1985. To look at the city from its design side and try not to actually change the city, but build on the character that was already there. If you asked my granddaughter when she was 3 years old, she said, all I do is widen footpaths and plant trees. And
not a bad...
and thank you.
Not a bad job description.
Yeah. And in many ways, that is a good summary of what I do, because I think the street is the most important space in the city. It makes up 80% of our public realm. And therefore, if you design a good street, you design a good city.
In preparation for the conversation today, we looked back on your exhibition and publication, Between the Street and the Sky. And that's really to your point, the point that you just made about streets being so critical to good cities.
I hate to try and make the dilemma we're facing with cities sound simple, but it is. There are only possibly five or six things a good city needs, and they are things that needs a reasonable density if it's going to work and you're going to support public transport and things like that. It needs to be mixed use so that you don't have to climb in a car every time you want to do something, that you can walk around the corner and do it. And those uses operate at different hours, so therefore you maximise the use of your infrastructure. It needs a high-quality public realm, and that's in the main, the street. It also needs, you know, good connectivity. You need to be able to get around, walking, cycling, public transport, and the car. And finally, it needs to be local character. It needs to be of itself. You don't want to reproduce some other city in your city. Why would anybody come if they could see it somewhere else? And if you look at those things, they're the things that make up good cities. And I don't think that's very difficult once you take those five things and say, how do we overlay that on our cities? And the interesting thing about Los Angeles and Melbourne is they're very similar cities. They're very low density, very widely spread, and they rely on the motor car to a large extent to get around. And the challenge is, how do you change that?
Just picking up on that idea of the similarities between Los Angeles and Melbourne, we're interested in the nitty-gritty of that at a governance level. We've been talking a lot about public perception, especially around buildings and planning, and that for a lot of people, they expect that the city is in control of buildings that are sprouting up all over Melbourne, and yet it's very complex. Can you talk us through where your jurisdiction starts and ends, and also how you navigate that complexity?
The Los Angeles example is particularly complex. I wonder how it would look from the perspective of Melbourne. My position, as I mentioned, is in the mayor's office. So we have some jurisdictional complexity within the city. So we have 15 city council districts within the city, and that's relatively few given the size of the city. It's about the same population-wise as Melbourne. It's about 4 million. We sit within Los Angeles County, which is 10 million. And that is governed by a board of supervisors, just five supervisors, each of whom has 2 million constituents, so really remarkable. And so our transportation system, for example, is run by a county agency. And then meanwhile, within the city, in terms of the work that I'm doing, a lot of land use authority, for example, has traditionally run through the individual council offices. So we're negotiating all the time these sort of inter and intra-city governance issues. And certainly it is left to the mayor to articulate a vision for the city from an overarching point of view. And so there are certainly a lot of opportunities for us to think about citywide design. Rob mentioned the public realm. That's a real focus of mine as well. What we call the public right-of-way, so that is the space between from building to building across the sidewalk and through the street and then across to the sidewalk on the other side. And there something like a dozen agencies, public and private, that touch on that space, and they don't always talk to one another. So one of my goals is to really put together a kind of comprehensive design strategy for that right-of-way. But as we're investing heavily in rail, and as we're investing in public infrastructure of all kinds and attempting to draw people into the public realm, we are forced to reckon with the fact that we've neglected that space for a long time. And so we really need to think about how to better design that space. And then there are new challenges and new pressures on that space as well. So particularly, I would say, in terms of climate and in terms of technology. So we have climate change. You know, we have sea level rise, as you do, to worry about, but also intense heat. And so we're thinking about cooling and shade really as an equity issue, is something that I mentioned in my talk as well. And that's a tree canopy issue. That's a street furniture issue. We're renegotiating our street furniture contract across the city, and it's an architectural issue. And if you look back to our own architectural traditions, and I quite like what Rob said about a city that needs to be of itself, and I'm very interested in this question of what it means to create an authentic Los Angeles design. Just as a brief tangent, I think that issue is complicated, perhaps uniquely in Los Angeles, because it's been a city that, one, has been so fixed on reinventing itself in the future, but also because it's the center of the entertainment business in Hollywood, we have created various simulacra, versions of ourselves that have often showed up or borrowed from Hollywood. And so we have played and created many versions of ourselves over the years. So that, combined with our history of displacement and displacing communities of color, means that this question of an authentic sense of place is more complicated, perhaps more fraught than it is more layered in other places. So that focus on the public realm also has to acknowledge new uses and pressures from technology. So we have startups who are interested in using that space. We have dockless scooters and e-bikes, like many cities do now. we have a conversation emerging about urban air mobility, and because we have a history of aerospace and aviation innovation, there are a lot of startups that see Los Angeles as a kind of testing ground for this new kind of technology. So all of those pressures and needs suggest to me that we need to have this kind of overarching design strategy in a way that we never have.
Rob, would you like to kind of talk a little bit about the different layers of governance that you need to negotiate in your role?
The city of Melbourne is quite small. It's the CBD grid, the old HODL grid, and the inner suburbs, so East Melbourne, North Melbourne, Carlton, and now pushing down to Fisherman's Bend. In 1985, there were only 35,000 people who lived in that municipality. So that's tiny, and that, I suppose, was an expression of the donut effect, that people actually lived in the suburbs. Today, as we move towards 200,000 in a city of 5 million, we're still relatively small, but we are the central city. And the governance that sits over that, if you talk about the political governments, obviously we're the local government level. We have councillors. They don't any longer have wards. When I started, there were wards, but they now all look at the whole city, and they have portfolios rather than wards.
And can I interrupt to ask if you think that's been a positive change in terms of the work that you do?
Very much a positive change, because what I've found is that, I've been responsible for actually setting the capital works budget for many years, and what used to happen was a bit of port barrelling, you know. I wanted so much in North Melbourne if you were going to have it in East Melbourne. So you couldn't think strategically about how to spend money. Everybody wanted their bit. Now that they're actually responsible for the whole Melbourne, what they will argue is from one portfolio, sustainability is important, from another, transportation is important, and events and culture are important, all of those things. And it's a much healthier debate. And, you know, when Barber wrote his book, Should Mayors Rule the World? I think there's a bit of truth in that. I mean, we've just watched the politics of our country stick its head in the sand and not deal with the climate. Whereas mayors don't have that luxury. They've got to look at the whole spectrum of the city, and therefore I think you get a much more balanced level. So we're tiny. We sit in the middle of all of this, but we've never restricted ourselves to that debate. And sitting over us is the state government, who then have all the authority. They are the planning authority for all major developments. And above that, the federal government. So local government, in my mind, and I never thought I'd find myself saying this because I never thought I'd be in local government, has this interface with the community. And it's the level of government that I think best understands how cities are changing. And a lot of our role is advocacy, because we just don't have the authority. So we have to deal not only with the three levels of government, we've then got to deal with the agencies, you know, Vic Roads, City Power, all those agencies to make things happen. So you need to become a very good advocate. And if you get things done, we find we spend a lot of other people's money, because we actually, I'll take the title of a recent book we produce, Urban Choreography. We choreograph how those agencies come together to change a city. And that's, I find, an extremely exciting role to play. Sometimes frustrating, not always fast. I think people think you can change a city quickly. It happens over decades. You mentioned the little exhibition we had, I think it's about 18 months ago, called Between the Street and the Sky. And having back in 1992 put in place Postcode 3000, which was to increase that population from 36,000-odd to close to the 200,000 today, I think people got carried away with the excitement, because also in the 85 plan was an understanding that as you rebuilt the city, you would try and keep within the character of the streets at least. So you used to go up to 40 meters and you used to set in, and then you could have a building above. What that did is it actually preserved the very small sites, the pubs on the corners and things like that, because they weren't viable financial parcels. And slowly what happened at a state level is they started removing those. This is about creating jobs and all those things. So setbacks got removed. So every single site in the city became a development site. And suddenly we have, and the classic example is on the corner of Elizabeth Street and Therry Street by the Queen Victoria Market, where they knocked down a pub. And, you know, this just rises up with eight stories of car parking from the footpath. And that was the dilemma of this exhibition. To what extent this drive to be up in the sky and have the fantastic views, do you actually achieve? Because we do want the density. And at what cost to the street? And I was just hoping to draw some awareness to that sort of dilemma we face.
And with this exhibition and publication, I'm interested to understand how this feeds into the recently released city design guidelines.
What it did try and reflect on is that we'd been in that space of the design guidelines in the 80s, and what we were trying to do was actually reinstate it. And so it was just an element of trying to get people to think a little bit about the sky in the street. And I'll give you a simple example which the design guides go to. The reason you don't want to take a very small site, stack it up at 46 to 1, which is mostly the highest floor area factor in most cities in the world, is that all the services for that then end up at street. So that's where they want their substation. That's where they want connections, you know, for the fire hydrants and all the other services, the entry into the car park if it's got it. So you end up with a door into a building and the rest of the street is services. Well, you do that often enough and you kill your street.
I'm struck by 46 FAR. We have a de facto height limit in Los Angeles in the form of a 13 to 1 FAR cap, and that's a floor area ratio cap. So we have had a long history of really fascinating debates about height and vertical architecture in Los Angeles, going back to the early, early 20th century. So as early as 1905, 1910, we had ballot measures about what the height limit ought to be in Los Angeles. And we had really fascinating arguments on either side. Some people saying we would never be a modern, truly modern city until we embraced the tower, vertical architecture. The other side saying people had moved from cities like Chicago and New York and come to LA, particularly because of its horizontality. And they thought the connection to sky, climate, particular quality of light in Los Angeles, the relationship to landscape meant that we should be closer to the ground. And that continues to be a debate. And we had a 150-foot height limit until the mid-1950s. And when we retired that height limit to permit a little bit more vertical architecture, to kind of assuage concerns about becoming, too dense with towers, we put in this 13-to-1 FAR cap. I'm fascinated by that because it means if we wanted to permit some pockets of height, which I think might be worth doing, we'd have to take that question to the voters and we'd have to have another one of those public debates, which I think would be fascinating, really worthwhile.
We were discussing between street and the sky, actually in relation to the initiative that you were talking about at the Living Cities Forum, Christopher, which is around that 80s and 90s architecture in Los Angeles and the case that you're starting to build, knowing that in the future there will be challenges around those sites. Can you talk us through that initiative?
It's really the case that buildings tend to fall out of fashion when they get to be about 20 or 25 years old. They fall into this period of inattention or they're kind of shadowed. And even if they're designed by a good architect, if you see a building that's 20 to 25 years old, it's most unfashionable, right? And then buildings tend to be demolished between the age of about 25 to about 50. And most preservation guidelines kick in at the national level in the United States, the federal level. It's a 50-year horizon, so you really can't nominate a building for that kind of distinction until it's at least 50 years old. And the idea was that society needed that time to sort of decide which buildings were most worthy. I've begun this effort to identify the most important buildings from the 80s and 90s and to map them and to begin to make a case for why the most important of those ought to be perhaps worthy of preservation, as inevitably some of them will come under threat of demolition. And it's a particular challenge, not just because they're relatively young, but also because that work, when it was new, was quite interested. That's the so-called LA School Architects. We have a particularly strong crop of buildings from this era. Early work by Frank Gehry and Tom Main and Michael Rotundi, Hank Koning and Julie Eisenberg, Australian architects who've worked in Los Angeles for a long time. So that work, a lot of that so-called LA School work, was quite interested in challenging conventional notions of beauty or bourgeois taste and tried to be unpretty or even ugly in some cases. And so making a case for it when it was new was difficult, and it's particularly difficult now that some of it's fallen out of fashion, right? So before I took this job in the mayor's office and continuing now, I direct a series of public events in coordination with Occidental College, which is a small college in LA where I teach. And it's very important to the mayor that this position that I hold have public engagement as a central part of what we're doing. So we did an event at the Museum of Contemporary Art, a building in downtown Los Angeles designed by Arata Isozaki, the Japanese architect from the early 1980s. He was given the Pritzker Prize just a few weeks before the event. It was a nice coincidence for us. And the mayor came and introduced it, and the new director of the museum, Klaus Biesenbach, came and talked about his appreciation for the building, which is imperfect in some ways. And they have a second venue, which is is designed by Frank Gehry, which was, in, I think, to my point about a city that reinvented itself always, it meant to be temporary. It was called the Temporary Contemporary. It was a redesigned warehouse in Little Tokyo section of downtown, and it's still going strong. It's now renamed the Geffen Contemporary after David Geffen made a gift to make it permanent. So the events and this effort is largely to understand the work from the 80s and 90s on its own terms, and then to begin to, you know, as a city, to make distinctions about what the most valuable work from that period is.
And I think the interesting thing about that is, I mean, I think one of the most successful programs we've run is Postcode 3000, which is to bring back the residential population. And a lot of people forget that it took advantage of those old buildings. Because after the crash in the property market in the late 80s and everybody had overbuilt commercial office buildings, what happened is they had to lower their rents in the new buildings, and so they drew the energy out of all the old buildings, and they were sitting empty. And a lot of them were 1960s and earlier buildings. Nice floor-to-ceiling heights, solidly built, you know, not too much glass, in fact, environmentally quite good. And we just showed how you can convert that. And to me, one of the biggest challenge our cities face is adaptation. And this was a small example of taking old building stock and reconverting it into another use, residential.
We had a similar policy change in Los Angeles, which was quite successful. So if any of you have been to Los Angeles, recently we've had quite a renaissance in our downtown, driven by an increase in our residential population. And that really owes itself to a change called the Adaptive Reuse Ordinance in the late 20th century, which allowed commercial buildings to be converted with a minimum of red tape, dispense with parking requirements, most crucially. And that was really the first seed. That policy change was the first seed that led to the renaissance in downtown that we're seeing, with the residential population having more than tripled since then. And there was always a discussion about whether downtown would come back. And there was a series of false starts. And it was really that policy change that really that kind of pushed downtown over the edge. So now it's become quite thriving as a residential center.
Now, that's a policy I'd like to grab, because adaptive reuse, as I said, I think is our challenge. And if we take it to the larger scale of, you know, both our cities on a metropolitan level, if you look at Melbourne, and I'll just tell us a brief story. I mean, I went to the university in the 60s. I'm a baby boomer, and traveled in 69 in my fourth year as an architectural student. And all the exciting architecture around the world was universities. And they were expanding Bochum, Essex, Sussex, all over the place. Came back to Cape Town and asked, what are we going to do? We're sitting on the side of Table Mountain. We're surrounded by a national park. We can't expand. And they said, we're asking a different question. The question we're asking is, how much are we using? And lecture theatres were 17.5% of the time. So they didn't build. They re-timetabled. And 30 years later, they'd trebled their students and built hardly anything. And the only noticeable difference I found on the campus was how vibrant it was. And that sparked me to think, well, what if you did that for a metro city like Melbourne? And the outcome of that study was you could double the population of Melbourne using 7.5% of the land in and around the existing infrastructure, train stations and tram lines and bus lines. And you didn't have to build higher than 5 to 8 stories, so coming back to that height thing, and get the reasonable densities. But the surprising thing is he saved $400 billion over 50 years in infrastructure. So the city would become more sustainable, socially vibrant, and financially successful. Yet we're heading the other direction. We just carry on expanding.
We've spoken a bit about the positive outcomes of some of the interventions or policies, and we've touched a bit on some of the unintended outcomes of those initiatives. There is understandable criticism of some urban renewal projects, gentrification, displacement. What do you both see as some of those unintended consequences of your own initiatives?
I'd love to tell you that Postcode 3000 was a huge success, and in many ways it was. But the downside was the gentrification of the downtown, and with that, the cost of living downtown, which has meant that a lot of the people who used to live downtown, artists, co-workers and that, have now had to move out and further away from where they need to be to partake in the city. So we have a real issue in producing affordable housing, and therefore getting the spread of mixed use in terms of the personalities we need in a city. So that's a big challenge, and we've tried to address that. We've done a number of schemes, which I could talk about, that have, you know, built back affordable housing. We're building one at the moment at Queen Victoria Market that actually has got 56 affordable units in as part of the redevelopment. So that was a big challenge. Initially, the challenge was that the services weren't there for the new population, so we didn't have supermarkets downtown. People, if they wanted to buy a pint of milk, would battle, you know, to find a place to buy it. So building back those facilities had to occur, and that's occurred. But the biggest problem now is with that density that's coming back in is the affordability, but also open space. And I was in charge of the parks and gardens for about 8 or 9 years, and we did an open space strategy. And if we had to buy the open space we needed in our city, it would cost us $700 million. Now, we don't have those budgets. So one of the successful programs, and it's a program of adaptation, we started back in the 80s, and I call it Grey to Green. We just started stealing the road space. Lygon Street was one of the first. We widened the footpaths and planted trees. And we've gone through and we've now taken almost 90 hectares of space out of the central city. The biggest ones being built at the moment are South Bank Boulevard, where we're creating 2.4 hectares of open space, and University Square, we've taken out two roads and expanded the park. So that policy of doing that means we haven't had to go and buy land. At the bottom of Errol Street in North Melbourne, a 500 square metre roundabout turned into a 5,000 square metre local park. That saved us $14 million in land. And we could reinvest it. So I am hugely optimistic about what cities can do. I wish we'd stop talking about our hairy problems like climate change in such an abstract notion and just ask the question, if climate change is a problem and over 50% of us are living in cities, what can you do in a city to assist in climate change? And you go urban forest, city as a catchment, greater green, you know, the list goes on. We can solve these problems. But we've got to actually contextualise them and make them everybody's problem, not just government's problem.
And a problem of the everyday as well.
Absolutely.
That's such a great reminder of the work that you've done in terms of bringing back green space into the city through simple, like, lateral kind of thinking like that. Christopher, when at the Living Cities Forum, you spoke about the river in Los Angeles and the reclaiming of public space around the LA River. Can you take a little bit of inspiration from what Rob's just described as well?
Absolutely. I was just going to say I've been really impressed walking around looking at the urban design of Melbourne and particular things that I want to bring back to Los Angeles. I've been looking here in other cities, just the simple gesture of having a bench, for example, that turns away from the curb and back toward buildings is to create a kind of outdoor room is a really simple and effective gesture. So we have a long way to go on that front, and I start my talk with a picture of the kind of neglected public realm that's we have pockets of really well designed urban realm, but they're not equitably distributed. That's for sure. So the river is both our greatest challenge and opportunity. The river cuts through the entire city. It's 51 miles long in all. About 2/3 of that is within the city limits of Los Angeles. It goes all the way for your listeners who will know Los Angeles from the upper northwestern reaches of the San Fernando Valley all the way through the valley, cuts in around downtown, and then goes straight down to Long Beach. And the downtown of Los Angeles, the first settlements, indigenous settlements, first Spanish colonial settlements, Mexican and then Californian American, are where they are because of the river. It's a seasonal river, and over time it flooded quite disastrously with some particularly deadly floods in the 1930s. And so we made the decision to channelize the entire thing, all 51 miles of it, and wrap it in this sort of concrete straitjacket, as so many cities around the world have done.
And we thought we were bad in Melbourne.
Well, it's not, yeah. Mooney Ponds Creek is a concrete channel.
Yeah.
So this is this sort of notion of engineering expertise, and that there's a one-size-fits-all solution, a kind of monoculture, right? Just in the same way that freeways are monocultures, a channelized river is meant to do one thing and one thing only, and that's to take stormwater during periods of intense rain and send it out to sea. Now, of course, we don't have the luxury of wasting that stormwater in the way that we have for so many years, but also the byproduct, the sort of paradoxical byproduct of that effort to channelize the whole river was to make the river and its banks disappear as a public amenity. So we wrapped it in concrete, but we fenced it along its entire length. It was really turned into a kind of no man's land. So even native Angelenos in the middle of the 20th century might have been unable to tell you that we had a river. And the Los Angeles Times, my former employer, did a series at one point, sort of rediscovering the river and telling readers that we had one, even though they might not have noticed as they commuted over bridges over the river, you know, into and out of downtown. So the challenge now is to maintain the flood control, because if anything, climate change will mean that the periods of rain will be even more intense. And then open up the spaces along the river to public access. And in our beaches and in our foothills and mountains, we have a great store of public space, green space in Los Angeles, but it's at the periphery of the metropolitan area. And so there are many communities, particularly south of downtown, that are really park poor by national, international standards. Many of those communities are within walking distance of the river. And so if we can turn those spaces into newly greened public spaces, we will be addressing not just the public space deficit, but also public health issues and transportation mobility issues as well. And as we densify the city, as we move away from the kind of model of the single family house, it means that people will rely on open spaces more than they have. In the 20th century, instead of building one big central park in Los Angeles, we built tens of thousands of miniature central parks, each in everyone's backyard. And that was a very powerful, appealing model. But a lot of those single family houses were not available to families of color because of racially restrictive covenants and loan practices, which didn't make the GI Bill, for example, and other federally subsidized home ownership programs available to African-American families, for example. And also those single family houses have become out of reach in terms of affordability for the middle class of Los Angeles. So we have to think about truly public open spaces that people will want to use if they're living in a different way. So the particular part of the river that I showed in my talk is the so-called G2 parcel, which is part of an old rail yard along the river, 42 acres that the city purchased about 2 years ago and is now in the process of turning into a new park open space right along the river. I mentioned the river is 51 miles. This space is almost exactly at the midpoint. It's right about mile 25 and a half, 26. And it connects to two state parks owned by the state of California on either side. So we have the potential of having more than 100 acres of contiguous open space at the very geographical center of the city right along the river. So there are significant challenges because it was a rail facility. There is significant environmental remediation that will have to happen because of toxicity in the soil. And there are also anxieties, to your earlier question about gentrification and displacement, there are anxieties about what public investment in this site will mean for the adjacent communities, Cypress Park in particular, and Frogtown, another one on the opposite bank of the river. So we are engaged in both a shorter-term design strategy. We've brought in the Spanish architecture firm Selgas Cano, whose work I quite admire, to do what we're thinking of as kind of immediate activation to bring people to a portion of the site, and then meanwhile pursuing a longer-term design strategy, which will include that remediation and thinking about making the entire site safe for the public over time. So it's one of those places where these questions of displacement, gentrification, our water policy, our open space policy, the design of the public realm, all come together. We have funding for a bike and pedestrian path along the entire length of the river, all 51 miles. And so we've been having, it's fascinating, design conversations just about the alignment, where the path goes. It has to be equitable and going from bank to bank. It has to sort of swoop under and over and around existing bridges and rail infrastructure along the river. And then we haven't even got to the design question about what an appropriate design strategy would be in terms of signage, wayfinding, to what extent we want a design strategy which will signal the scale, the macro scale, all 51 miles, be consistent along the length of it, but also be flexible enough to reflect the different diverse communities that the path is running through. And of course, it will have to be a balance between the two, but that's a fascinating question. And what makes Los Angeles really unusual at this moment is we have identified funding, and voters have really supported funding for all of these projects. So that's just one of the examples of how much, in a fundamental way, how we're rethinking so much of our public realm and its design.
During the Waterfront program, which our last episode was about and was part of Melbourne Design Week, we talked a lot about the importance of getting people close to things like rivers and how that changes perception. And we get close to it, we care about it, and we start to want better for its future. And when we think about natural environments in general, you've both talked about climate change a little bit, but I'm really interested in this, in the kind of the interesting times that we're living in with existential threats like climate change, like species collapse, how you make sense of that on a day-to-day level and how you communicate or if you even need to communicate what you're doing is in response to those kinds of threats.
Look, I think you need to communicate it. And I think one of our biggest difficulties is what is the narrative that makes it accessible? And that's why I brought in that thing about, you know, try and contextualize it. So, I'm an incrementalist by nature. So when I looked at the 1975 plan when I first arrived in 83, they were saying big things. We're going to underground the trams and, you know, Bourke Street, and we're going to do a whole lot of things. And I sort of at the time said to the councillors, if that's the strategy you want, I can't give you that because you haven't got the money and I'm not just going to do that stuff just to have it in a book. So I think part of the thing with climate change is if we can get a narrative that says this is all our problem, and it's across many levels. Christopher's mentioned, you know, for instance, just channeling water into the ocean. We should try and keep water out of pipes. The best place to store water is in the ground. So permeable surfaces, whenever we can get a permeable surface, whether it's on every development site, walk down Little Collins Street, you'll find each tree pit is actually set below the street level. So the water flows off the street into the tree pit, into the ground before, in a big flood, it gets into a drain. So I think there are hundreds of actions that we're taking. But I think there's a feeling of the community is, well, government should do that. But we shouldn't. So if I go back to the metro strategy and say we're putting our population in and around tram lines and bus lines, the space in between, like directly the property behind the tram line, is the new green wedge in my mind. So you don't go in there because you don't have to. We've just shown you can put the population adjacent to that infrastructure, so you don't have to invade that. So in the new green wedge, what you do is you plant trees. You capture your water. If every house in Melbourne went back to having a water tank like we used to have before mosquitoes made that a dubious thing to have, you then put solar panels on your roof. So the best thing I think the Victorian government's doing at the moment is it's just extended accessibility to solar panels for, you know, I think it was about 35,000 families. That cumulative energy that builds up around those programs is the thing that really keeps me optimistic in the morning and allows me to look with straight face at my grandchildren and say, you know, we're trying. Because if you just try and do the big things, they'll elude you. We can see how, you know, trying to stop a mine or trying to do that can actually just sway politics. Whereas some people just don't even notice what you're doing. So here's the dilemma. How do you incrementally steal 90 hectares of asphalt out of a city to reposition it away from cars to pedestrians and bikes and not get it stopped by governments to say you're going to cause congestion? Yes, we're going to cause congestion. In fact, congestion is the best thing for the city in terms of changing to a new paradigm. And in certain areas, you're going to have to use congestion as part of your weapon, but you can't be direct about that. It's only in the last 18 months you hear the city now talking about, you know, that's what we're doing. We're taking asphalt out. We're causing congestion. We don't want city people driving through the city. But it's taken us 30 years to get to that narrative. We don't have 30 years with the environment. So there needs to be a new narrative, and we all need to take responsibility for it.
In terms of climate change, that's a real focus of our mayor, Eric Garcetti, and one of my colleagues, the chief sustainability officer for the city, has just relaunched with the mayor an update of our sustainability plan for the city as a whole. It's quite ambitious. It's sort of been rebranded as a Green New Deal for Los Angeles following the conversation that's happening in Washington. So this has been a strength of the administration and continues to be a real focus. And Los Angeles has really emerged as a leader along those lines in the national conversation in America.
You spoke back at the Living Cities Forum about the design competition you're looking to launch around housing. I think you mentioned the triplex and the fourplex as a typology that you're really interested in interrogating. And it can support the scaling up or the densification of the city from that really important middle ring. Can you tell us more about that initiative?
The housing question is our most vexing question, because the model of the single family house, which I touched on a little bit before, was such a powerful and glamorous idea, and architecture really served that. I showed an image by Julia Shulman of one of the case study houses, and I think most architects around the world will be familiar with this visual language of the glamour of the modernist house in Los Angeles, often perched on the edge of a hill looking out over the basin. And to get back to this question of what's quintessentially Los Angeles, the paradox of being quintessentially LA by its remove from the rest of the city, right? That's what makes that photograph so powerful, so complicated. So as appealing as that was, it's not a sustainable model for building the Los Angeles of the 21st century. That's clear. So a couple of things have happened. One is that we've begun to understand in a way that is really crucial the relationship between housing policy and transportation, and how mobility and how and where we live have to be absolutely linked as a matter of policy. And in fact, we won't have the ridership on public transportation that we want and need and are building towards until we change our housing policy. So at the state of California level, there has been a really aggressive push by one state senator in particular, Scott Wiener, who comes from San Francisco, to really compel cities that have not met their housing targets to build more housing. And he has proposed in two successive legislative years new legislation, first called SB for Senate Bill 827, and this year SB 50, which would allow significant upzoning or greater density for residential projects along and near transit lines, rail and frequent bus lines, as well as in what he describes as job-rich areas, whether or not they have transit. So that's been a very controversial bill, because it would mean that single-family neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are zoned only for individual houses, could be dramatically upzoned to include building residential buildings as high as 75 or 85 feet tall. So there was a lot of backlash against that idea, and it really illuminated the fact that our housing policy has been largely determined in Los Angeles, as is true across the state of California, by those who are secure in their housing, who are homeowners largely, as opposed to those who are facing insecurity in their housing or future residents of a neighborhood. And that's also a challenge. How do you design and make room in the policy debate for those future residents of a neighborhood or a city? So SB 50 was ambitious enough to be shelved again. But I feel, from the mayor's office side, that it opened up the debate in a very productive way, and that there's a lot of territory that is between the single family house or the, we've also done a lot of work on the second unit, the accessory dwelling unit, ADU, so-called granny flat, right, which has been quite successful in Los Angeles. We've produced a lot of those units, but there's a lot of territory between the second unit and the 75 or 85 foot residential building that would have been allowed under SB 50. And when we look at research about the most effective ways to produce more affordable housing, we are really seeing a lot of data suggesting that it's this mid-rise project at the level of the, let's say, the triplex, fourplex, about that size, that is the cheapest to build and can produce most quickly more affordable options.
I think you've got to be really careful there, you know, because some of the backlash you'll get, and this happened in Melbourne, is if you allow that to happen anywhere in the residential area, and I've seen the data and I've had friends who are economists who argue don't cut out that option. But we got the six packs in the 60s, and they were that. They were, you know, up on stilts, parking underneath.
Yeah, we call those dingbats, actually.
Dingbats, okay. Yeah. Six pack is also a beer. You know, that's right. How you carry your beer. But I think the important thing, and this comes back to how, again, you propagate that density, and I think, referring to the 7.5% city, that means 92.5% of it doesn't have to be increased in density. So one of the things I think where our planning scheme fails, and I don't get to make a lot of friends when I say this, is that it's still in the 1950s. It still looks at a city in terms of 76 different zones. And that's what we did. In the modernist period, we simplified the city by saying this will be Industry 1, Industry 2, Industry. City is mixed use. There's only one zone in a city, and that's mixed use. But there are different time periods of maturity within that. You have a city that is actually mature, I'd call it stable, and that would be in our city, the heritage areas. And so if we only had three zones in the city, we said everything's mixed use, and we said we're going to identify the stable areas, those areas which we don't want to change much. And they would be the areas between these corridors as well. The next level is areas you want to go through incremental change, and they would be our central city, and that'd be those corridors and things like that. And then you write the policy around that. And then you say we have key development areas. They could have been, you know, greyfield sites that are now being redeveloped, and you can write the policies around that. Then the planning scheme starts to tell you where you want development and the nature of that development. And you eliminate this debate that everybody goes to bed at night fearful of a six-pack growing up next to them.
I think in our case, the legacy of single-family zoning and the kind of stability that you've talked about is absolutely the product of exclusionary zoning, which I mentioned before. So I think part of it is starting with the reckoning of the ways in which equity and wealth building were only available to white residents and homebuyers. And so I think as we look to that past and we look to a future of climate change, we have an obligation to be thinking about what the future of those lower density neighborhoods looks like. Now, I absolutely take your point about the political complexity of that, and it's perhaps even more complex in Los Angeles than here, but I think we also have a particular architectural legacy to look back on. LA is known around the world as the city of the single-family house. I mentioned the appeal and the power of the case study program. But in fact, in the pre-war, pre-World War II decade, so from the tail end of the 19th century through World War II, we produced a remarkably rich number of examples of multifamily living around this scale. So beginning with the bungalow court and then the sort of Mediterranean courtyard apartments that are well known through noir film, through the early work of important modernists like Irving Gill and Schindler and Neutra, all of those architects were doing really innovative multifamily, what we call multifamily work in that period. And so we have in our own DNA a kind of architecture before the single family house, before the freeway, before the car, all of that, that we can turn back to and sort of see as authentic to Los Angeles. And so for me, it is so politically tricky. That's one of the reasons that I'm looking at a design competition, because I think we have to put this question on the agenda. And we're not perhaps ready to do it at the level of the city council. In fact, the city council was voted unanimously to oppose SB 50, this bill. So it's, reflecting the kind of difficulty of this from a political point of view. You know, and there's certainly places where my job will be to focus on a particular policy change. And I mentioned the adaptive reuse ordinance as a model of how that can be effective. But other times it's just putting a question on the table, putting it on the agenda, asking architects to help us imagine new ways of living, new typologies that can help us break away from this model that, as I mentioned, really isn't sustainable in terms of building the future city.
Actually, just picking up on population growth for a moment, we talk a lot about the increase in population in Melbourne, with projections from nearly 5 million to nearly 8 to 10 million, depending on the source. 10 million is a lot of people by 2050. So what are the population projections for Los Angeles, and what are you responding to?
So it's quite interesting. We're very much in a post-growth environment in Los Angeles and a post-immigration environment. So immigration peaked in Los Angeles County in 1990. So we're a city of second and third generation immigrants, which means that those communities are much more stable in terms of their financial condition and their sort of community ties. But also because we have failed to build enough housing, and I ought to have mentioned in connection with the last topic that after all those dingbats were built across the city, and they're called that, I should say, because they often had names which were affixed in script to the front of the building. So there's a kind of generic architecture. You drive underneath, and just as you described, and then we would call them the Monte Carlo or the Fontainebleau, right? And then that would often be written in script along the front of the building, and then there would be, so dingbat is a typographical, so a little starburst, for example, would be next to the name. So that's how they got the name dingbat. Because we built so many of those, and in so many of them in single-family neighborhoods. And in fact, that's how we housed the immigrant population during our periods of most intense immigration. That's after federal immigration policy was changed in 1965. So between 1965 and around 1990, the dingbats really sort of welcomed all of these new residents, and it was very effective middle-class, working-class housing. Because so many of those were built, we had a backlash against growth in the 1980s, and we passed a couple of propositions that downzoned much of the city. And so made the production of additional housing to match our population growth through the 80s and 90s until around 2000 impossible. So we have a deficit across LA County by most measures of about 1 million housing units. So even though our population is not growing nearly as fast, we have a deficit to make up for. And in fact, one of the reasons we're not growing in population is that people can't afford to live in Los Angeles. So we have an outflow of people moving to the kind of regional fringe or leaving California altogether. And so we don't have the kind of population growth that we've been known for. And that is its own kind of a challenge, because what connected what I describe as first Los Angeles, you know, between the late 19th century and World War II, and then the second LA, which produced all of the tropes and stereotypes, right, that we all know of, the city of the car and the single family house and the swimming pool, and I've described this emerging city as third LA. What linked first and second LA was headlong growth, this idea of growth as an industry, and growth is perhaps our chief industry, the so-called growth machine, the idea that we could grow our way out of any problem. And that's very much changed. So as a post-growth city, we finally have a chance to kind of consolidate some of those gains and think about what kind of city we want to be. But as I mentioned, we also have to make up for this housing deficit, which is, you know, has caused a housing affordability crisis.
Does building more houses solve the housing deficit? Like, I'm interested in the impact of things like Airbnb and like the kind of gap between home ownership or rental availability and like how many empty places are there, I guess, is my...
Well, this is the million-dollar question, yeah. Right? How much does building, increasing market rate supply, how much does that increase in affordability across the board? And that's one of the reasons we're looking at this so-called missing middle. Because if you build a brand new apartment building, because of this deficit of housing, the prices are almost automatically high, and it becomes luxury housing even if it wasn't designed or built that way, or even if the architecture doesn't match it, just because there has been a shortage of that kind of new housing. But that tends to filter down only indirectly to lower levels of affordability. And so the data that we're looking at suggests that building somewhere in the middle, triplexes, fourplexes are cheaper to build. You can do them in wood frame. That's the kind of building that we know how to do, and I assume something similar is the case here as well. That filters in both directions, sort of from the middle. And, you know, this is an inexact science still, and it's very contentious, this question of whether it's a supply question. It's also, to your point, it's a matter of protecting the existing supply. So that means thinking about regulations, but also tenant protection, rent control. It's become clear that it's a strategy we'll have to pay attention to both ends. So producing more housing, producing more affordable housing, and also thinking about protecting the affordable housing stock that we have, and that no solution will succeed unless it's thinking across that spectrum. And we're actually producing a lot more affordable social housing than we ever have, thanks to a couple of ballot measures that provided funding for those initiatives, particularly permanent supportive housing across the city at a scale that's really unusual. Los Angeles, because of its political history, has traditionally been quite skeptical, even hostile to the idea of public housing. And so, unlike New York or Chicago or other American cities, we don't have the track record of building and maintaining public housing at the same scale. But that's beginning to change. And so we're sort of embarking on this new initiative to build quite a bit more than we have historically.
I think Melbourne's in a different situation at the moment. We're in that growth situation and rapid growth. I'm not an apologist for rapid growth. In fact, I think urbanisation is actually one of the solutions to the planet. I think the faster we urbanise, the greater possibility we have to actually grapple with that big problem. But coming back to the city level, in this rapid urbanisation that's occurring in Melbourne, the opportunity lies there not just to think of it as an economic driver, which it is, but to think, well, can we use this to reposition the city? Part of the change that needs to happen with our property is a move away from where development has become something someone builds and sells to someone else and has no responsibility down the track. So when I see apartments being built and they said, oh, we're now going to build for rent, is this a good thing? I'm going, right on. Of course it's a good thing. If one company has to own that building for 25, 30, 50 years, they're going to build it to a reasonable quality because, you know, it's going to have to be, you know, good in year 50. So I think we're in a fascinating period of growth, and we can see the emergence of young, new thinking. The problem, fundamental problem, is such a small percentage of our housing is ever designed and built by architects.
It's been obviously a big conversation in Melbourne about heritage and preservation during a time of rapid transformation. And Christopher, you've spoken about civic memory in Los Angeles. How do you preserve a city's identity, the very thing that makes it so appealing in the first place for so many people to come and live and enjoy, while still allowing enough space for freedom, progression, regeneration, for the future city to emerge?
I see it as continuity and change. You know, how much of the past do you want to keep and how much do you want to change? And everybody's going to have a different view on that. My view is I've renovated, lived in, worked with heritage buildings all my life, but never to actually take them back to museum status, to actually think, how do we take this building that is so important to our city in order to keep it, but give it another 50 years life that is actually an economic life, and that's going to be the thing that preserves it. And that's a difficult path. I mean, there are a lot of people who just want to keep everything exactly as it is, and I get that. And they're very important civic buildings, which you want to do that with. But for instance, we would have lost many of the buildings in the central city had we said, you know, they've got to be in their original role, because the original role had passed. And we've just seen the Capitol Theatre retain, Burley Griffin, but they've done some work on the outside and they've linked it into the arcade. And that buoys my spirit, because that overlay of the past with a new life is exciting. And we're going through this challenge at Queen Victoria Market on whether or not you can take this icon that we all love, but very few of us actually go and visit, I must say, and change it to make it viable in the future so that in 10, 15, 20 years' time, we've still got a market. And navigating that is quite difficult, because people remember it when they were a kid, and they wanted to stay like it was when they were a kid. But retailing's changed. People who are selling there now are, you know, my age, you know, they're into their 60s and 70s, and their kids don't want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to a market and pick up a whole lot of veggies and bring them back. So how do you keep a food offer at Queen Victoria Market? One very simple change, and this is going to be controversial the moment I say it. If you go to the Adelaide Market and you go there on a Friday night, the market's open, people are sitting there, they're buying the food, they're drinking, they've got their families. It's the most vibrant time. Ours is closed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we're not recognizing that the community that lives around that is changed. They're not driving in from Mount Waverley to go to the market anymore. They are local. So, you know, the idea that you need a car park because people drive up in cars and fill their boot with food, people don't do that anymore. Some people do, but a lot of people won't do that. They'll go and buy what they're going to need that day or next day and want to come back the day after and refresh it. So there's a big shift we've got to make in the way that we look at these things if we're going to keep them viable. But the ideal outcome is you can make that change, and when people go there, they can't recognize the change. And that's what we've done with the city. People think it was always paved with bluestone. It never was. You know, there's a bit of bluestone in Spring Street. We just in 85 said every footpath's got to be bluestone. People think this was a treed city. It never was. So people look at it and say, this is the way it always was. And the challenge of the Queen Victoria Market is when they look at it in 10 years' time, they say, oh, this is all the way it always was, but it'll be operating in a different fashion.
In the American context, very few cities have managed to strike an effective balance between continuity and change, as Rob nicely put it. I think of Chicago as one city that has managed to really protect its important historic architecture while also supporting younger architects, new innovation. It's perhaps a particularly challenging set of questions in Los Angeles, because what has marked LA and what makes LA has been this openness to change and reinvention. So if what is quintessentially Los Angeles is a kind of openness to change, what does that mean in terms of protecting old buildings, right? It's a bit of a paradox. So I think I've been struck by how architecture once was one of many arts that Los Angeles was open to. So Los Angeles has always been a great place to be a painter or a writer, a musician, or a chef, a young chef who wanted to open a restaurant.
Sorry, architecture was always one of those categories, but it's become an expensive and regulated, in some ways, more conservative place. So it's not an easy place for younger architects to get a foothold. So I've been thinking a lot about how we can, you know, Los Angeles now has a fantastic food culture. It's probably the most interesting place to eat in the whole of the United States. And that's because the barriers to entry for young chefs are quite low. You can get a food truck, you can open in a strip mall, and you can, without much capital investment, you can be starting a restaurant and doing something experimental. We need to figure out how to get architecture back into that category. We've run out of room. We've run out of room to expand, and it's hard for young architects to find clients who will support them and take a risk on them. So given how much investment we're making in the public realm and how much public building we're doing, I've been thinking quite a bit about how the city itself can be a patron, a client, a patron of this kind of architecture. So that starts with a reassessing procurement, how we're picking architects for public projects. I'm very interested in a particular kind of procurement strategy that can attract a younger, more diverse group of architects and perhaps pairing them with smaller scale civic buildings where we can take a risk on, we tend to, as most cities do, reward those big offices that have become quite good at landing public work as opposed to being good at being architects and producing good design. And so we have to strike that balance in a new way. And we have an opportunity to do so because we're just building so much more on the public side than we have in many decades.
Well, this will be our final question. And I'm going to kind of touch back on the future. A young horticulturalist said to me once that there's a phrase, an old saying, that he keeps in his mind when he's working and that drives his work. And it's, a society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they'll never sit in. And I'm wondering, what do you hope in the future is the shade that the people of the future are sitting in from the trees that you planted?
Well, I hope that everybody who lives in the city will get as much enjoyment out of living in the city as I have and my family have. That means that we only own one car amongst two families, because even then it sits idle for 80% of its life, maybe 90% of its life. We can walk to everything we need. We use public transport. We live close together with my daughter's family, so we still share in a traditional way the duties of a family. That before I came here this morning, I can swim a kilometre in a pool that's just down the road, and it's open air, the Fitzroy Pool. The sheer luxury of that as an urban experience is something that I hope everybody can benefit from. And I know they can if we have the courage to stop selling the cheapest way of living is to have a house and land package on the fringe. Because what we don't tell when we say that is you'll have to own two cars. You'll have to pay $8,000 in tolls each year. You'll have to climb in the car every time you want to buy something. And by the way, you're going to spend, 30% to 40% of your life sitting in a car, getting to work and back. So that's the part of the story we're not telling. So we need to take the city and be brave enough to turn it back on itself, to repopulate the spaces in between without destroying the character of, those residential areas, and we can do that. And when I'm long and gone, Melbourne looks like that. I'll feel I've had a very small part in trying to make them think about that eventuality.
Oh, I love that quote that you read, and I think Rob's example and Melbourne's example is tremendously inspiring to us, to particularly thinking about the long time scale. American culture, LA culture, tends to be very impatient, and I think the introduction of Silicon Valley in that culture has only intensified that idea that we're continually reinventing ourselves, looking for the next solution that will change the world immediately, instead of investing in these longer term strategies that can remake the city. And this was a real focus of mine as a critic, is trying to remind readers and now Angelenos, as I have moved into this new position, about how long it does take to remake cities and how investments that we make, even if they don't immediately pay off, can be worthwhile, and in fact the most important kinds of investments. I was always struck when I would write about our transit investment, for example, and our expansion of our rail, subway, and light rail network across the county, how often, if I talked about a line that was going to open in 2040 or something, I would get emails from people saying, I'm not going to be alive. You know, there's this assumption that everything has to happen right away. And so, you know, particularly in terms of taking the city back from the car, for example, we spent 75 years in Los Angeles remaking the city in the name of automotive efficiency, what Rainer Banham called Autopia, the British architectural critic and historian who came and wrote a book really celebrating that post-war LA urbanism. So others have called it motordom. You know, we spent 70, 80 years building motordom, and it's not reasonable to expect that we will dismantle that regime and rebalance the city for all of its users overnight. It will take many, many decades. What makes it politically tricky is we have trained multiple generations of Angelenos to think that the job of city government is to remake the city, to make their car travel as efficient as possible across the city. And I quite like what Rob said about the city not being a place that you drive across, you know, that we will always have automotive traffic and that will be part of our planning and urban design. But we have to, again, to rebalance, recalibrate, and make sure that the city, the streets, the sidewalks are working for everyone who's using the city. And that will take time. And luckily, the trajectory in LA is all in the right direction. All of the investment we're making every time, there was a long time, every time we remade a street, it was to widen the space for cars and narrow it for everyone else. And about 10 years ago, that flipped. And now almost every time we remake a street, it's to widen the space for pedestrians, cyclists, et cetera. But we have a lot of, you know, it's such a big city as Melbourne is. We have so much of that remaking and rebalancing yet to do, and that will take a long time. So it's important to keep in mind this notion of slow and incremental, as Rob put it, change and the benefit over many generations.
A very big thank you to Christopher Hawthorne and Rob Adams for so generously giving their time for this episode. We hope you take a moment to think about the past and the future when you're next moving through your city, to consider not only the changes you question, but also those that you're grateful for and the kind of urban legacy you want to leave for future generations. You've been listening to Future Needs, the second episode of This Is Public, a podcast series produced by Open House Melbourne.
We're an independent organisation that fosters public appreciation for architecture and public engagement in conversations about the future of our cities.
This Is Public episodes will be released every 2 months, give or take. Learn more, including where and how to listen, at openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic.
A deep thank you to presenting partner Metro Tunnel Creative Program and supporting partner the SB, who have brought This Is Public to life, and to Open House Melbourne's generous donors, partners and supporters.
This Is Public is hosted and produced by us, Emma Telfer and Sally McPhee, with support from Brianna Carroll and Victoria Bennett. Our music and sound design is by Dan West, and our audio editor is Chris Andrews.
We record at the SB Podcast Bar, Tweak and Twang Studio, Number Station Studios and on location.
This Is Public is created on the ancestral lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging.
Thanks for listening.